welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Laurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. The Anglican Communion, an organization of 38 different churches with 77 million members in 164 countries, began 500 years ago when the Roman Catholic Church refused to recognize a divorce by Britain's King Henry VIII. This week, another deeply personal situation, the election by the United States' Episcopal Church of an openly gay minister, Canon Gene Robinson, as Bishop of New Hampshire, threatens to split the worldwide church apart. And a long-time relationship between the world's major oil consumer, the United States, and the major oil producer, Saudi Arabia, may be in serious trouble. The problem is a report on the September 11, 2001 bombings that implicates a Saudi government worker. The Bush administration has kept the pages dealing with that situation secret. The Saudis want it made public. The two international splits, one religious, the other political, are the subjects for today's program. To discuss the Saudi Arabian-American relationship, we have today David Jones, international editor of the Washington Times in Washington, Dr. Houman Peymani, a columnist for Asia Times Online in Geneva, Switzerland, and John Bradley, managing editor of the Jeddah, Saudi Arabia-based Arab News. To discuss the Anglican Church turmoil, we have Jane Lampman, religious writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Boston, Massachusetts, and Mobolaji Aluko, an online columnist for NigeriaWorld.com and NigerDeltaCongress.com. He is also a professor of chemical engineering at Howard University in Washington. Let's start with Saudi Arabia. John Bradley, why is it that the Saudis want to make a report that appears to implicate them as perhaps financing to a great extent Al-Qaeda? Why do they want it made public?
Well, they want it made public so that they can defend themselves. I'm not sure. I think the key word in your question is implication. There's a clear implication, but most of the people who've read these pages and subsequently commented on them have said that there is no tangible proof that the suspicion that Saudi money made its way to terrorists or terrorist organizations was knowingly given by the Saudi royal family. There is some proof that apparently that the money ended up there, but not that it was given in a deliberate fashion by the House of Saud. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, if these facts get out, then the Saudis feel that they will be able to put up a pretty spirited defense. What they're doing at the moment is feeling that they're the victims of insinuation and a sort of smear campaign.
David Jones, I imagine that you are pretty well up to date on the report, at least from the Washington point of view. What do you think? Is it a smear campaign?
You know, there are a lot of people in Washington who don't like Arabs, period. There's others who are very, for legitimate reasons, have been concerned about Saudi Arabia for a long time. And certainly there's no question that, you know, Saudi Arabia for a long time has supported a rather extreme form of Islam and has funded charities and schools and so forth in any number of countries. And spreading this Wahhabi faith, which has become a breeding ground for a lot of the terrorists. So indirectly, there's good reason to be suspicious. The report itself, from what I read, apparently this Omar al-Bayoumi, who supposedly befriended two of the hijackers, helped them get settled in San Diego, and gave them money and so forth. He was working for the government. Was he just being a nice guy? It is in the culture. It's natural to try to help a new person to welcome them. This is very much part of Arab culture. According to the report, from what I read, it says this guy was probably an agent of the government without offering proof of that. It says he may have reported to Saudi officials, again, apparently without offering proof. So you know, there's a lot of speculation and supposition involved in here, which is why it's upsetting to everybody. As far as the Saudis, their foreign minister rushed to Washington, went in to see President Bush, obviously he still has very good access and is welcome here. Did not get the report released, but didn't even seem to be all that unhappy as he was leaving. A very interesting thing in the reports to say, at least we have showed people we have nothing to hide. And I think part of this was, they, even if they didn't get it released, they were able to show the American public that they were ready and willing to have it released. And that from a public relations point, they achieved at least part of what they were after.
Dr. Peymani, you are more or less detached from the story, living in Geneva, Switzerland. How does it appear to you? Is there a deep Saudi involvement with al-Qaeda, or is Saudi Arabia being, as we say, bum-wrapped by this report, or what?
Well, I have found it unrealistic to suggest that the Saudi government directly or indirectly assisted at some point in the past al-Qaeda, because that organization had the main objective, which is the overthrow of the Saudi government. So it doesn't make sense for the government of Saudi Arabia to somehow help a group which seeks to seeks its destruction. Going through the publicly available information, I really have not found any strong evidence to actually implicate the Saudi government. There are some speculations about, as the other participant mentioned, about the possible friendship of a Saudi person working for this for that government with two terrorists who then turned out to be involved in the September 11 attacks on the United States. That really doesn't prove anything, and at best it shows that perhaps that person was somehow suspected about the activities of those people, and if the suggestion is true that he probably worked for the Saudi Secret Service or he was spying on Saudi dissidents, that really doesn't prove anything more than that perhaps the Saudi government was suspicious about the activities of certain Saudi nationals in the United States and was trying to keep an eye on them. So I really do not see any strong evidence, any proof or anything to somehow give me at least any idea that how the Saudi government could be involved.
If we could just ask David Jones. David, do you think it's possible that the Bush administration does not want to make this public because 28 pages are so vague?
You know, there's probably several reasons. One reason they say is because they don't want to reveal sources, and this is a very real and powerful concern within the intelligence community that they really hate for anything to get public that reveals how they get their information. And I gather some of this information, though, came from, like, FBI informers and so forth, and they may be trying to protect that part of it. There is also a sense that Saudi Arabia is helping in the war on terrorism, and they don't want something that's going to embarrass the Saudis and possibly interrupt that cooperation that they're getting. It's a delicate line. The same we see in Pakistan, where there's still a sense the Pakistan government is looking at the other way. It's some bad things that are happening, but in other ways they're helping us, and we're not willing to blow the whistle.
Yeah, Dr. Peymani makes a good point when he says that al-Qaeda is interested in overthrowing the Saudi government as well as doing great damage to the Western world. Why would the Saudis be helping them?
Well, the Saudi family is very big. I think at the highest levels of the family, absolutely they're not. They threw him out of the country after 1991. When he became a problem. But for he was a big hero in that country for many years before that, during the fighting the Soviets in Afghan. A lot of people became very close to him. This is a very large family with many members, all of whom have lots of money to throw around, and it's entirely possible that some mid-level members of the family and lower levels feel some kind of ties or loyalty to him and would continue to support him. I don't think at the highest levels it makes any sense.
Yeah, John Bradley, what about the Bin Laden family? They have been able to maintain their position in Saudi Arabia, haven't they?
Yeah, indeed. I went out to the outskirts of Mecca the other week with a couple of Bin Laden's nephews, and we had a picnic and we drove our four wheels up some sand dunes, which is what the young kids do here to entertain themselves. And They were talking about changing their names. It's been the government has agreed, it seems, that the Bin Laden family can in fact change their names on their passports and on all their official documents, so that when they travel abroad, they won't be stigmatized in the way they are now. But as far as their dealings within the kingdom are concerned, things are absolutely normal. In fact, the one bin Laden I know, he's in his early 20s, and he is at a college studying in Jeddah. He is he's suffering the reverse from any kind of fallout of being associated with his uncle. In fact, he's revered by most of the his fellow students, and they tell him.
Yeah, have the bin Ladens in Saudi Arabia completely cut their ties with Osama?
But it seems that well, obviously the standard official line is that they completely cut their ties
right.
many years ago. But there is talk that some members of the bin Laden family did maintain contact with him right up until the Afghan War, and there's also talk that he was slipped back into Jeddah in the late 90s to attend a wedding, but there's no proof for any of that. David was saying something interesting about the Saudi royal family being so large that inevitably that means that it's very diverse, and so to talk about the Saudi royal family being like this or like that is really a non-starter, because like most families, you know, there are lots of people who have different opinions, and I think the bin Laden family too, it's nowhere near as big as the Saud, but it is a large family, and so inevitably you will get different reactions from different parts of the family, different generations, and so on.
Do any of you have any concern that the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia will split seriously? David, you go first on that.
You know, there's been a lot of speculation about what were the underlying reasons for the war in Iraq, and one that keeps coming back is the idea that some people in the administration had decided that Saudi Arabia could not be trusted over the long term, and by liberating Iraq from Saddam, that we have made ourselves less dependent on Saudi oil. I think there are at least some people in the administration who do see that there will be a long-term split and have already gone about, you know, making ourselves less dependent on them and making that more possible.
Okay, we are a little short on time. John Bradley?
Yeah, I think there's certainly in the long term the relationship is going to be redefined very dramatically. The Iraq oil is going to take 5 to 10 years to make a big difference, but it is going to make a difference. Similarly, the Americans don't need Saudi Arabia militarily anymore. They've shifted down here to Qatar. And
mm-hmm.
so for both of those reasons, the Saudis, I think, to be frank, are really in for it. Give it 5 to 10 years, and we're going to see very dramatic developments on the U.S.-Saudi front.
Dr. Peymani, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think this American administration has not been very positive about Saudi Arabia to start with. There is a concern, at least shared by some of the some of these administration's influential people, that Saudi Arabia in the long term will not be stable. So if there is a problem of future stability, there is a concern that the country cannot be relied on for the long-term interests of the United States in the Persian Gulf. So I believe that at least some people within that administration doesn't mind to see a regime change in Saudi Arabia, perhaps in the near future. But whether they are going to get themselves involved directly or try to actually create or generate something of that nature, I'm not sure that it's going to be feasible.
Okay,
Dr.
Peymani, I'm sorry, we have to take a break. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Let's move now to the controversy in the Anglican Church as the result of the election of Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire in Minneapolis. There is talk that this will split the church, perhaps in the same way that the Anglican Church originally split from the Roman Catholic Church 500 years ago because of the divorce of a British king, Henry VIII. How possible and how likely is this? Jane Little of the BBC, who is now now joined us. Would you like to go first on that?
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly we've heard a lot of opponents of the election of Gene Robinson talking about a schism for quite some time. And, of course, before Gene Robinson was elected and before this whole controversy, we had a similar one in the UK over Canon Geoffrey John, a gay man appointed to be Bishop of Reading. He was under such pressure that he withdrew before he was even consecrated in order, he said, to preserve unity. So, there is the real threat of a breakup here. Having said that, supporters of Gene Robinson and those who have devastated that Geoffrey John stood down are saying, we've heard it all before, over the ordination of women, for instance, here in Minneapolis in 1976, and it never happened. On the other hand, it has to be said that homosexuality and this issue does seem to go much deeper, and there's all sorts of political and theological and cultural battles going on within this. So it does look like the most serious crisis to face the Anglican Communion.
Professor Aluko, Nigeria's Anglican Communion or Anglican Church is perhaps the most conservative and I think also the largest. This move has been condemned in Nigeria. Is it likely that the church there would split away?
Well, I mean, this is the third time that the Nigerian church, the Anglican Communion in Nigeria, which is about 17 million out of the 70 million, has been given an opportunity to say something. I mean, when the new Westminster Diocese in Canada approved a same-sex marriage, the Bishop of Nigeria led a group of 15, I believe they call themselves concerned primates, to declare impaired communion with that diocese. And when Canon John, I believe, was to be was appointed, and of course he finally decided not to take it on, the Nigerian communion also threatened to resign, to pull out of that. I mean, the one for UK, I believe, is probably more serious than the one for the United States, primarily because the spiritual head comes from the UK, and the US is only 2 million people. So I would think, too, that Nigerian communion will declare impaired communion and move on. I don't think that it will, this in particular, will result in a split, but it again depends on how the rest of the communion takes it.
I have to chip in there, Jane Little here. I have to chip in and suggest that I feel that it's as serious, but it's more serious, is this crisis here caused by the election of Gene Robinson. He is the first openly gay and non-celibate bishop within the Anglican Communion. Geoffrey John agreed to be celibate, and that didn't assuage those who were against his appointment. We've got a large, broad spectrum of opinion against homosexual priests. Some say they're okay as long as they're celibate. Others say they're not. Geoffrey John was forced to step down. But this is a huge crisis for the Anglican Communion.
Well, but you see, the United States has been traditionally thought of as being a liberal country. I mean, so it is not a huge surprise that something like this would occur. I mean, I would almost say that it's in Nigeria, it will even be a surprise that there are Anglicans in the U.S. I mean, when you say Episcopalian, it does not quickly jump into the minds of Nigerians or even many Africans that they are part of the Anglican Church.
I'd like to jump in here, too. This is Jane Lampman. I think it's very interesting, however, that the Archbishop of Nigeria's statement that came out after the approval of Canon Robinson indicated very strongly that they were extremely disappointed, but also that they would be working closely with the people who oppose this in the U.S., and he even said, we will do all that is necessary to actualize this bond in practical terms, end quote. So it seems what I think has given an additional impetus to the possibility of split is there seems to be quite a strong relationship between the conservatives in the U.S. and Anglicans elsewhere, such as particularly Archbishop Akinola.
Yes, and I think that there was a group of American Episcopalians who wrote in solidarity with the I believe 15 concerned primates. So there is a bond, and the days are still early, I believe.
But having said that, Jane Little here, 5 years ago at Lambeth Conference of the Worldwide Bishops in Canterbury and in England, we saw this campaign had already started. This has been going on for a while, and we see these loose networks, and often not that loose networks, of people affiliating across different nations. And there was talk at Lambeth, the Lambeth Conference, of evangelical conservative American bishops getting together with African bishops and Asian bishops to strategize. They were expecting this battle. It's not that much of a surprise. And, you know, how true it is that money's been, you know, funneled to African bishops, and that they're, you know, basically setting up a real concrete network. We don't know that yet, but it certainly sounds likely here. We've already, ahead of this vote, heard threats from Archbishop Akinola of Nigeria of a dramatic realignment of the Anglican Communion. So they have been plotting this for quite some time.
Well, a realignment, yes, of the Anglican Communion generally. But Jane Lampman, how about in the United States? Is the Episcopal Church going to split?
Well, I think you have the real possibility of members and some parishes, perhaps even some dioceses, that might take that step. I think they're going to be very deliberate about this. They're planning to meet in Texas in October, those who are extremely concerned, and decide what their response would be. But I certainly have talked with some people who feel very deeply about this, and I think they're... the question will be how widespread this is, whether this is a split or simply a splinter, I guess you could say.
Conservatives, Jane Little here, conservatives in Minneapolis, very quickly after the election of Gene Robinson was confirmed, announced, as Jane says, the meeting in Texas, and they also... they also put it in the strongest possible terms, that they believed the Episcopal Church in the United States had put itself outside of the Anglican Communion, and they said they wanted to continue their relationship with the Anglican Communion. The clear implication of that was, you know, we are no longer a part of the Episcopal Church. Having said that, I didn't observe a massive walkout, as some had predicted yesterday, and I think that it's language games, it's semantics at the moment, but they're important. They're not using the term that we've broken away and are setting up our own church. And there's a lot of mundane matters here. We've got expensive property, we've got pension funds, we've got collection plates. There's all sorts of mundane as well as serious principle
points. All the practical considerations.
Absolutely.
A meeting in Texas in October. At the same time, Bishop Robinson, if I may call him Bishop now, in October will be off to London, I think a week before he is ordained, to England, to speak in Manchester, at a meeting of a gay Anglican group. Why is he doing this? Is it a lack of sensitivity on his part, or is he doing it to prove a point?
Well, he's been booked for some time to do that, and he's supposed to be the keynote speaker at this event in Manchester. There are a lot of connections between gay and lesbian advocacy groups within the church in Britain and the US, and, you know, there's a sense of solidarity there that they've not been fully included, and certainly the... I suspect it's meant to provide a boost as well to the gay and lesbian community within the church in the UK, who are bitterly disappointed over the withdrawal of Geoffrey John from his appointment as Bishop of Reading. They saw that as a huge blow for the church, and also they were furious with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, who himself supports such inclusion. He is on the liberal side, but the poor man's walking a tightrope here, trying to hold a very, very fractious Anglican communion together. And many people felt Geoffrey John was sacrificed, and now believe that he was sacrificed pointlessly, because we now have a gay bishop anyway.
Mm-hmm. How large is the gay and lesbian movement in the church? Who wants to go on that, Jane Little?
I guess gayness and lesbianism is such a private and individual orientation that is just now it's coming out more closely. I doubt if there will ever be a census of that done. So I'm not sure.
I couldn't venture. This is Jane Lampman speaking. I couldn't venture to give any figures, but there are certainly very active groups within a good number of the churches. And I think this is what has given impetus to it in the U.S., is that these are church members who want to be full participants in the church. And so you have, like Integrity within the Episcopal Church and Reconciling Ministries within United Methodist, there are groups within each one of the denominations. And so they have been the ones that have been pushing for this, and the response is a pastoral response. In many cases, those who support them feel that they have to recognize the pastoral needs here, and so I think there's a significant movement within each of the mainline churches, and then there are some who even in relation to evangelical churches.
But this is not to deny the fact that there are serious, serious problems against homosexuality in the Bible. I mean, it's not the church is not just a compact between individuals who decide to do one thing or the other. The Christian church is based on the Bible, and there are serious injunctions against homosexuality in the Bible.
Okay.
Well, it depends how you interpret the scriptures, and that's how the debate's focused in on.
Okay.
Here
sorry, everybody, but I'm sorry to say we are out of time. Our guests today have been David Jones, international editor of the Washington Times, Dr. Houman Peymani, a columnist for Asia Times Online in Geneva, Switzerland, John Bradley, managing editor of the Arab News of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Jane Lampman, religion writer of the Christian Science Monitor in Boston, Jane Little, religious affairs correspondent for the BBC in Minneapolis, and Professor Mobolaji Aluko, online columnist for NigeriaWorld.com and NigerDelta.com in Washington, D.C. Our director is Pat Akers, our producers Yusuf Kalyango and Sarah Katan. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, a journalist. We'll be back next week.